Word on Today FM.
It's time for the Culture Club, and we're delighted to have Mark Geary with us. And he's with us because last month he released his new EP, Antebellum. And let's just hear a little bit of a track from that called Headlights.
Last night, half light, curled up in your toes. Driving last night, radio on the go. Maybe they might play some Rolling Stones. Ask me, I swear I won't even deny. That night, I swear that I thought I would die. Woke up full of holes, patched me up and go.
Headlights by Mark Geary. Mark, you're very welcome to the Culture Club.
A pleasure, it's lovely.
Antebellum is an EP. Is it sort of a companion to your last LP, is it?
It doesn't feel like a companion. It might feel like a marker for somewhere else. It just happened really, really, really fast. The fastest I've ever done a piece of music. In January, all musicians look at January as the kind of the lean month because people are broke after Christmas and, you know,
they're not going out.
And no one's
not buying tickets for
they're
gigs.
Not doing nothing. So I looked at that like everyone else and thought, okay, maybe I have scraps of little lyrics and things. If I call the label and say, could you finance a couple of days recording or whatever, can get it done fast. So that's it doesn't feel like a companion. It feels like a. Like some signpost to somewhere else.
Well, where do you want to go?
Yeah. And where?
Where do you want to go?
Me, myself?
Yeah.
Everywhere. I don't know. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about being a musician. I don't necessarily know where I'm supposed to be going. Or
how many albums at this stage? Six, is it?
Six or seven.
Or live albums as well?
Live albums and soundtracks and you know, just working.
It's what sort of soundtracks have you done?
Kind of independent film soundtracks. The one about the Latter-day Saints, stuff about you know, independent. What happens with independent film? It seems is that they make their movie and then realize there's no music, and then they call me to, you know, do the incidental music. And it's such an interesting kind of way to kind of make music, because they'll say, Mark, we need 9 seconds of music. And I write songs. So it's such a different way to...
And to get the tone right of the music.
Yeah, exactly. So you watch and you keep watching and you keep watching. And so it could be harmonies, it could be guitars, it could be Moog or whatever. Fantastic. It's such a different...
That sounds like fun.
It's great fun. It's late nights, but great fun. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go through your musical choices, which might tell us how it informed your own career.
Yeah.
And start for me with the first single that you ever remember buying. Or is it an album?
What was the first single? What did I say to you? I remember writing all of this for you. And
You have the first album that you remember buying, the first record, Rattle and Hum by U2.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about why that was the first thing that you bought.
I was working in a butcher shop not even as an apprentice, but as a kind of a helper after school. And I had back pocket money. I had money. And I remember going to Golden Discs, and it was a double album. It was serious money. And I was obsessed with U2. I was obsessed with going to gigs, and this was my absolutely the thing that I was completely focused on. And I remember actually even they opened, Golden Disc opened at 12 o'clock at night. You could buy it at night. And I queued up with maybe 1,000 people to buy the album. And that was my summer taken care of. I just wore it out, you know.
But do you still like it?
Well, let me see. So All I Want Is You is on that. Hawk Moon, 269. Angel of Harlem. I mean, there's some absolutely bangers on it.
And one we're going to play, Desire.
Yeah.
That Mark Geary, I think, is from the late 80s. For many people, U2 were brilliant in the 80s. Other people loved what they did in the 90s.
Yeah.
Did you continue with U2? If you had an obsession as a teenager, continue with your love of the band?
Octone Baby, absolutely, was a, you know, by Rattlin' Hum, it felt like they'd just been, had become so kind of tired of the, you know, the kind of the preachy and the whatever, and then Bono gets an alternative kind of persona. I love it. Locked Baby is fantastic. Absolutely. I stayed with them. I did. And then I went to New York and, you know, like U2 was almost like a visa stamp as an Irishman living abroad.
Yeah, you went quite young, did you?
I did.
In around 1990 or so, early 90s.
1992, the Donnelly visa. My brother put my name in for a lottery, and that's my name came up. And Carl had the Sinead Cafe with, you know, Jeff Buckley and Sinead O'Connor and all of this. So that was the kind of kindergarten.
Did you work there?
I did, yeah.
Did you get to play there?
Of course. I washed more dishes than did gigs, but absolutely. No. Sinead was the unofficial kind of Irish embassy in the East Village, you know.
I was only there once, the night that Ireland beat Italy in the World Cup in 94. I ended up spending the night
Stop
in
it.
Sinead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I went to that game. I was convinced that because the Irish and the Italians were the two really kind of prominent, you know, ethnic kind of communities. We all went thinking, okay, half and half. And we
took it over.
I don't know, completely. Giant Stadium was absolutely rammed with Irish people. And I went down to Little Italy that night in a kind of a mocking fashion outside of Italian restaurants with a tricolour.
But Sinead, and we did have your brother Carl in previously because he's now such an acclaimed novelist.
Yeah.
And for a culture club. But Sinead was a cultural, wasn't it? An exceptional place.
And it really was.
Yeah. Particularly with Jeff Buckley, the late Jeff Buckley's work there.
But then, you know, in the afternoon, there would be a guy sitting there kind of scribbling on and trying to get a script together, or, you know, we'd all kind of meet as if we were, you know, plumbers getting ready for the next job. And Sinead was incredible. And I do remember having to pretend that I knew what was going on. You know, you kind of acted as if until you start to wear the New York armor.
Did you get your confidence there, though, to perform?
Oh, 100%. Like, absolutely. What was great about it, Matt, was that you could be terrible on a Monday night, but there was so many other gigs you could play Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that you just started to, you know, I would go home, I'd be working, and then I'd write songs, and then I'd get to play them, and yeah, stage time, the graft, how to, you know, because I was obsessed with Dylan and, you know, all of what New York was, you know, I suddenly realized, okay, so this is the place to learn, you know.
When did you come back and why?
Kids, babas, and it felt really difficult to be doing all of this and traveling with young kids, and I came home to a Dublin that I couldn't afford, and went to the Midlands, went to Westmeath.
How long ago was that?
My God, it's got to be 20 years. It's got to be. It was such a. I remember hearing cows cough for the first time in my life. It was so alarming. I didn't realize that cows did that at night, and I was like, "What the hell is that? What is that?" And I was so used to kind of, you know, sirens and fire engines and rattling of the madness in New York, and my kids, you know, kind of were toddlers. And then I this is what...
What you brought them back to.
What I did.
Okay, favourite album. You've given us three favourite albums.
Okay.
And actually two of the favourite albums also coincide with favourite bands. You love the Beatles and you love Radiohead. So yeah. Rubber Soul is the Beatles album you've picked. Why that one?
Just the absolute pinnacle of playing and music and harmonies and... at that moment, you start to hear McCartney's bass playing much more. The BBC or you know, Parlophone were very suspicious and convinced that the needle would hop off the vinyl if you kept pushing. But of course, McCartney was listening to Motown and hearing James Jameson and these amazing musicians, and he kept saying, I really need to kind of push up the bass, and his playing You Won't See Me and Taxman, and it's just from start to finish, it's joyous, and the Beatles have always been joyous to me forever. I mean, it just a made up fantasy of a band, you know.
You also have Radiohead, and a lot of people give us OK Computer.
Yes.
Occasionally we've had the Bends. You've given us what I think is one of the great albums, particularly from about halfway in,
yeah.
Hail to the Thief.
Oh.
I just love stuff like A Punch Up at a Wedding and Myxomatosis and those tracks.
Yeah. I saw them in New York, and I'm just... It's not fair that they've actually done this album, because they've already have their page in the music annals or whatever. To do this one is just, it's outrageous playing.
And the other album you've given us, Kate Bush, and
Kate.
The Hounds of Love.
Yeah,
why would you pick that?
I was so in love with her. She was so beautiful and so English, you know. This, you know, looked like she'd come from some estate, wooded estate, and just the scope and her bravery. You know, she seemed to know exactly what she wanted to do from 16. I mean, you know, you get Dave Gilmour from Pink Floyd to play on Wuthering Heights, and then she built a studio and just made the music she wanted to make. I mean, and she never really listened to anyone. That's...
Well, from The Hounds of Love, let's hear a little bit of one of her best known tracks, Cloud Busting.
Tidy.
wonderful cloud busting from Hans of Love.
Stop it.
It's a brilliant one. We've already mentioned the Beatles and Radiohead favourite bands, but you've also added in the favourite artist, J.J. Cale.
For people
who are not familiar with J.J. Cale, I think great guitarist, wasn't he?
Wonderful guitarist, but also a phenomenal songwriter. Wrote Cocaine, After Midnight. His voice, it just feels like you've been invited into a barn somewhere in America, and it's just the band starts and no one is competing with it's magical. Troubadour, there's a bunch of albums that he has, and his playing, I'm sure I've leaned into maybe 4 or 5 of my own songs with that feeling, but kind of like J.J. Cale. Lads, like less, you know, less is more, as we always say in music, you know, just ease into it. And you listen to these albums that he makes, and that's exactly what he's doing. And he knows he can do a solo, and then he doesn't, right? It's the restraint. It's the, and his voice really close to the microphone, that kind of whisper vocal, the way I'm a huge Nick Drake guy as well. So that kind of, you know, there's no big song. He's just kind of whispering to you. Oh my God.
Okay, well, we're going to take one more thing before the break. Best gig. And lots of people have nominated Leonard Cohen in Dublin. Depends on the venue. Where did you see him in Dublin? Was it the Royal Hospital, Kilmainham?
It was the Royal.
Yeah, loads of people have nominated that, including Gabriel Byrne and others, as their favourite ever gig.
Yeah.
Why are you picking that one?
It felt like congregation.
That's exactly the phrase that Gabriel Byrne used.
That's what it felt like. It didn't matter what he was going to do. We were there just to say thank you. And this man who showed up, it was so elegant, and the suit, and he always kind of seemed to kind of capture a moment. That night, oh my God, like just the songs and even the way he talked to the audience, it felt kind of preacher congregation, you know.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the Live in Dublin album, Dance Me to the End of Love.
Dance me to the wedding, dance me on and on and on. Dance me very tenderly and dance me very long. We're both of us beneath our love, we're both of us above. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the end of love. Dance me to the children who are asking to be born. Dance me through the curtains that our kisses have outworn. Raise a tent of shelter now, though every thread is torn. And dance me to the end of love.
Let's move away from the music though, Mark, and let's talk about movies and directors. You've given us a list of directors that you love: Martin Scorsese, Stanley Kubrick, Mike Lee. But talk to us a little bit about Christopher Nolan.
I just even this week, it just, you know, sometimes you stick on the telly and a movie is on, and it was Batman Begins, and then the next thing I know, you know, 7 hours later, it's the whole trilogy, because you can't just, I just for him to tackle something that, you know, how many Spider-Man movies have we seen now? It just seems like, you know, flogging a dead horse. But he goes dark and he gives you the origin story, and Christian Bale is so great in it. And it's just fantastic fantastic shows.
Well, we have a clip from The Dark Knight, where in this clip, the Joker, played by Heath Ledger, explains to Rachel Dawes, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, how he got the scars on his face.
Well, hello, beautiful. You must be Harvey's squeeze.
And you are beautiful.
Well, you look nervous. Is it the scars?
You want to know how I got them? Come here. Hey. Look at me. So I had a wife. She was beautiful. Like you. Who tells me I worry too much? Who tells me I ought to smile more? Who gambles and gets in deep? The sharks. Hey. One day they carve her face. We have no money for surgeries. She can't take it. I just want to see her smile again. I just want her to know that I don't care about the scars. So, I stick a razor in my mouth and do this to myself. And you know what? She can't stand the sight of me. She leaves. Now I see the funny side. Now I'm always smiling.
You know what just strikes me? Listening to that, the soundtrack is incredible. It's just in that, isn't it?
Yeah. The menace of it. Yeah.
The music just.
And what's so great is that, like, he changes the story of how he gets the scars, depending on who he's talking to. He does it twice in the film. You know, it's a completely different backstory. So brilliant.
Are you looking forward to The Odyssey?
Yeah, so much. I found a way into Greek mythology. Felt a bit of a because it felt very intellectual or but I found a way in through Madeline Miller. She did Circe and the Songs of Achilles, and I'm obsessed with that kind of repositioning the kind of the women in the story. So Women of Troy, there's the whole bunch of books, kind of feminist books, I guess you'd call them, but they're actually just fantastic books. And already there's controversy because the academics are saying that it's not authentic, or it's, and you go, guys, this is
fiction to start.
This is myth. you get that part, right? So myth. I can't wait. I'm just to go, because it's probably going to be on IMAX screen, and it's just an event. I think that's what it was the same with Dunkirk. I went to the IMAX cinema so I could hear all of that amazing audio. Just an experience. Get excited about going to the films, you know.
Okay. Plays. You've gone for The Cripple of Inishman. That's a Martin McDonagh play, is it?
It is, yeah. Okay. Yeah, he had a trilogy, and this was the one I actually got to see in the Joseph Papp Theatre in New York, just because everyone seemed to be talking about it. And, you know, we were talking about Sinead. This was, you know, it was the play to see. And what I loved about it, and I think what he's continued, is that it feels like a guy that has watched EastEnders and Coronation Street and Brookside or whatever nonsense he was watching as a kid. And then he also was being told, you're Irish and pay attention to your culture and O'Casey and all of the greats. And he's kind of, it's so... He sends it all up, you know, the misery of it. It's all tongue in cheek.
We have a clip where Daniel Radcliffe is starring as Billy Clavin, the cripple, alongside Padraig Delaney as Babby Bobby.
Beautiful.
How did you hear tell of Helen and Bartley's travelling?
Helen told me.
Helen told you. Jeez, and I told Helen she'd get a punch if she let anyone in on the news.
I hear she's paying you in kisses for this boat trip.
She is. And sure, I didn't want paying at all. 'Twas Helen insisted on that clause.
What? Wouldn't you want to kiss Helen, so?
Ah, I get a bit scared of Helen, I do. She's awful fierce. Why? Would you like to kiss Helen, Cripple Billy?
Well, I can't see Helen ever wanting to kiss a boy like me anyways. Can you, Bobby?
No.
But so you'd have took the McCormick's without payment at all?
I would. I wouldn't mind having a look at this film and business myself. What harm in taking passengers along?
Would you take me as a passenger too, so?
No.
Why now?
I've no room.
You've plenty of room.
A crippled fella's bad looking aboard and everybody knows.
Since when now?
Since Potcheen Larry took a crippled fella in his boat and it sank.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, Bobby Bobby.
Or if he wasn't a crippled fella, he had a bad leg on him anyway.
You're just prejudiced against cripples is all you are.
I'm not at all prejudiced against cripples. I did kiss a crippled girl one time. Not only crippled, but disfigured too. I was drunk, I didn't mind. You're not spoiled for pretty girls in Antrim.
And don't go changing the subject on me.
Big green teeth. What subject?
The subject of taking me to the filming with you.
I thought we closed that subject.
We'd hardly opened that subject.
Sure, what do you want to go to the filming for? They wouldn't want a cripple boy.
You don't know what they want.
The cripple, well, of Finnish man.
It's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's really, it's magic stuff, you know. Just bringing us to the, you know, to the drama and then the madness of the characters that he, you know, it's all farce and tongue in cheek. And I, a lot of people really hated, you know, the movie, the Banshee and whatever, because they just, they weren't in on the joke. And the joke from the start, it's just, he's just sending it all up, the sweaters and the country and the, and two lads, you know, chopping ears off because I don't like you anymore. You know, it's brilliant.
Favourite books and authors. You've given us the likes of John Steinbeck and Hilary Mantel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why would you pick those out? And not the brother, Carl.
I felt because I was coming to see you, I thought, well, I can't. That's almost nepotism or whatever.
Juno Loves Legs was very popular with our listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Broke my heart. I mean, he kills me. We did a show together, the first time ever, where I sang songs and then Carl would read from his book. And then we realized that actually we were writing about the same thing. When I was in New York, I wrote about Ireland. When I landed back in Ireland, I was writing about New York. And it was really powerful. You know, memory yeah, and nostalgia and little things that had happened as kids and whatever. It would kill you. That book would kill you, you know.
But why was it, why Hilary Mantel?
When we were talking about the Greeks or whatever, she just illuminated, you know, Henry and Anne Boleyn, and so and it's a trilogy,
the Wolfhall trilogy.
Oh my God! And then the, you know, obviously Mark Rylands as Cromwell and whatever. I'd never read anything like it. Just completely humanized, and I understood. And
for the same reason, John Steinbeck, would that have been sort of an early young influence?
I it was East of Eden was the one. The other, he called it his other big novel, you know, obviously Grapes of Wrath, but it was East of Eden. And I'd started traveling as a musician. I'd started to go west and to get to San Francisco and Cannery Row. And then, of course, Dylan mentions a little Cannery Row and Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands. And it's just, you know, incredible that as an American writer, he's the most socialist writer I've ever heard. It's all the man's greed that he talks about. And there's a beautiful passage in East of Eden where there's an Irish kind of guy who has a kind of a homestead, and he's the kind of the soul of the whole book, and just looking out and going, I don't understand the cruelty, the malice and the hubris of all of these people all around me. It's really incredible.
You gave us as a television choice, Curb Your Enthusiasm. So let's just hear a clip from the episode The Wire, where Larry and Cheryl, who's married now to Robert F. Kennedy in real life, but anyway, meet their neighbours whose help they need to remove an unsightly wire in their back garden, but the neighbours have a request.
I'll just say it. She played Elaine on the show, Julia. He's obsessed with her. He thinks she's just the most talented actress in the world.
She's great.
Okay, she's not just beautiful.
Yes.
And she's not just talented. She's sublime.
Yeah.
And tell me if I'm going over the line here, but it's always been a dream of mine to meet Julia Louis-Dreyfus and just meet her in person. And if you could just make a phone call and make that happen, that would be so great.
You know what? I'm more than happy to call her up. I can't guarantee.
So no, it's so hard to get anything absolutely guaranteed.
Exactly.
It's like when it gets buried, you don't know if it's guaranteed or either.
No.
You don't even know if that can pop because there's a lot of papers to be signed. I agree with you there. I know I can make something happen. I don't say I think I can make something happen. I can make something happen. I just wanted to be clear that it's just a dream of mine.
I think you're pretty clear.
We have an understanding. This has to be buried.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give you my number.
Great.
Yeah,
great.
We'll do that on the way out.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
So nice to meet you guys.
So
would you like
nice.
To have dinner, too? I've got a nice casserole in the oven.
I would kill to have your casserole.
Yeah.
I really would.
Would you listen? I can wrap it up.
I can't do it because there's something wrong with my stomach. Okay?
Okay, you know what? Thank you so much for coming over. Let me just show you out.
Oh, my God.
Why did you pick Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I mean, just to have this hero, I think he's become a hero of just, you know, the obligation of social interaction. And he goes, he's so horrified and he just doesn't care on the golf course. And, you know, I met a lot of people like that in New York, you know, moneyed people that were just, you know, when he was writing for Seinfeld and, you know, there were those soup Nazis there, you know, there was rules that you had to, you couldn't understand. You didn't just order food. You had to behave in a certain way. And then, you know, like Latte Larry, which is his cafe next door to the cafe that he has a beef with, you know, Mocha Joe's. I just love it. 30 minutes each episode. It's magnificent. And then all the characters all the way through it, you know, they just become bigger and bigger and bigger. And
well, we've had just more than 30 minutes of Culture Club. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to stop there. Mark Carey, it's been great meeting you. Thank you very much for coming in. Antebellum is the new EP and there's loads of back catalogue there as well.
The Last Word on Today FM.